Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Michael Robert Fader. Actually, I don't know how I got the name Robert as a middle name. I don't know. My parents not being accessible, can't find out from them now. They weren't accessible even then, but I never did think to ask. I never liked that name. But on the other hand, it's my name, Michael Robert Fader. Once I worked for an employment agency, one of those deceiving hack employment agencies that posted jobs. This is way back when the jobs were posted in the Help Wanted in the New York Times. This is, I guess, archaic now with the internet. But there was this big section of jobs wanted, jobs available, you know. And there were these fake employment agencies that really didn't have the jobs, but they just lured people in. And they did have actually some jobs, but they weren't the kind of really nice jobs, interesting jobs that you know, that they advertised. And everybody had to have a fake name. Everybody had to have a different name. Now, the reason for that was, in this employment agency, was because most of the people that worked there were Jewish or Italian. So my name was Mike Roberts. And I couldn't call up and say, because most of, and what was the reason for that? Because most of the employment agents, most of the personnel people, the people who were in charge of personnel at the companies and at the corporations that we dealt with were WASPs. And it was a given for, I guess, maybe based on reality, that, that they didn't want to really talk to Jews and Italians. So we all had our fake names, you know, like some people have in broadcasting. So my name was, instead of Mike Fader, I would call up and say, this is Mike Roberts. And I never got used to it. I never got used to it. I once called up somebody and I said, can I speak to Mike Roberts? So it just didn't work for me. But the other day, people, I guess one other thing before I start off today. I already have started off, but one other thing is that people are used to this show being a kind of a soap opera. Sometimes it's more that way than other ways, but like, you know, tune in next week to see where I'm at or if I'm at or what I'm doing or what I did. And I know some people like it, and I know some people, you know, don't, but I think most do. I try to keep it on a higher, slightly higher emotional, spiritual, and intellectual level than an average soap opera would be, but maybe that's not a good thing. What's so good about that, right? What's so good about it? So this week there'll be more of that. So in other words, if shows sound the same, almost like continuations of the show last week, sometimes there is that soap opera, sometimes they have on TV shows last week on The Turning Point. Yeah, but anyhow, there is this kind of soap opera thing. Today there'll be a kind of continuing, the whole show is like a continuing pilgrimage. I guess it's been that way since I started out 35 years ago on the radio. The whole show is sort of like one long continuing pilgrimage in which I sometimes, it seems to me, almost blunder across something revelatory or worthwhile or useful for not just for me, but for people listening, which is kind of the dual point of this show and always has been for me, is to think out loud or feel out loud about what I'm going through or what I've done. And then in the hopes, which has been proved out over the years mostly, that other people are searching for the same thing. Because aren't we all, really? If we're searching, aren't we searching for the same basic things? Love, acceptance, understanding, some sort of spiritual connection, the connection entirely between us and the world and other people, how to get by in life, what the basics are, things like that. So I've been looking and looking, and sometimes I think I sort of stumble across the truth over those decades, and sometimes I just get completely lost. And in the last year or so, I've definitely been, it's sort of like the beginning of Dante's Inferno, in the middle of my life, although I'm far from being in the middle of my life. I found myself, what was it? I'm paraphrasing. In the middle of my life's journey, I found myself in a dark wood. Well, that's where I find myself in the last year. And you are listening to somebody wandering around in the woods looking for something in the dark wood. And so I consider these things sometimes. I take these little pilgrimages to discover some sort of shrine or a place where there is blessing or grace, right? That's where I head through the woods and deal with the monsters and all the mythical creatures and try to arrive at a place like that. But I may be in error about that. Could be it's more like Dorothy. There's no place like home, or home is where the heart is. In other words, all this wandering around might not just be what I think it is. It might not be a way of finding something by painful search. It may be a way of avoiding what is right in front of my own eyes. And I think sometimes that's more true than I ever knew before. Anyhow, the other day, this is not much of a segue, the other day, I think you're aware of this, President Obama visited, first, apparently it was the first time that a president of the United States ever visited a federal prison facility. That's something. All the federal laws and all the federal rules and all the millions, hundreds of thousands of people who have been locked up in federal prisons for all this time, for a couple of hundred years. He's the first president, apparently, who ever visited a federal prison facility. And it was, I think it was a maximum security prison, a federal prison in Oklahoma. I forget the name of it. And he was walking through it, and they showed him a typical cell, you know, a toilet with no toilet seat. I mean, really a disgusting, awful, bleak, painful existence for whoever was in that cell. I guess they were out at the time, you know, doing some activities or in the yard or whatever. And he said, "There but for the grace of God, there but for the grace of God," and went on to expand about how that could have been him who was occupying that cell. It might have been him occupying that cell. Well, I don't know. I don't know. But maybe in his mind, and maybe, who knows, a possibility. Here he is with his, you know, with his skin blacker than a white person's skin, which just seems to be one of the only requirements for being thrown in prison a lot of places, you know, and a mistaken, an aggressive cop or a mistaken identity or an ignoring of people's rights. And we have this gigantic black prison population. And he himself, and he mentioned that when he was a kid, I think that he had smoked marijuana and maybe once or twice used other drugs. And he said he could have gone that way. Well, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But, I mean, on the other hand, he's a complicated guy. There's a lot about him that I detest, actually, and this Trans-Pacific Partnership and many other things, all this drone stuff and the NSA that he's pouring money into and the spying and continuing the same old stuff and never really going after the rich. I could, you know, the list goes on and on and on. So I'm no fan of his. And yet, he will occasionally do something really right, really good. And there are many things like that. One of the most recent one is that he issued, I think it was 46 pardons to people who were in jail for minor, relatively minor, or drug offenses that really weren't dangerous to anybody. And he was making a point. There's a lot of people. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of mostly men and some women in jail who don't belong there, who don't belong there, because these are drug offenses that can't be treated in jail, and they don't belong in there with the murderers and the rapists and, you know, the bank robbers and everybody else who's in there, a lot of these federal prisons. So he's making the point. And so I, you know, I good for him for that. But he said, "There but for the grace of God." And yeah, I often think that. Do you think that too? On your life's journey, you look at somebody who's worse off than you or whose life is a disaster, or either you know them or they're in your family, or more likely somebody you pass on the street. This is a kind of a city pilgrimage that I'm taking. This is a mini city pilgrimage. Maybe things are different out in the country, but maybe they're not. No, you might look at somebody down the road or somebody who's poor or screwed up, or maybe they're a drug addict or they're out of their minds, or they're like, you know, they might really be in poverty or things are bad. And you might say to yourself, "Well, there but for the grace of God." It's true. You know, God, all right, you could argue with me, but it's a phrase. It's some people say there but for fortune, you know. Yes, I mean, you work hard and you make your own life, something that that I've never been that good at. You know, I sort of relied too much on fate and fortune and luck and never really built up a solid foundation for a life where I choose what I want to do at each juncture in my life, where I make decisions based on what's decent for other people and maybe for me, right? But there but for fortune. Sometimes you just have bad luck. Sometimes you just have bad luck. Up until the time I was almost blown apart by my aorta splitting about a year and a half ago, I was doing pretty well. And that's just fortune. That's just that they told me it was a genetic ailment that one out of, I don't know, whatever it is, 8,000 men have this happen to them. But so, you know, up until then, I kept thinking, and I still think that. So the other day, as you know, I've been trying to take meditation seriously. Now, that's not going to do it for me completely. I mean, it's not really an aggressive enough treatment for the kind of things I suffer from physically and mentally. But searching for some kind of stillness, it doesn't necessarily have to be peace. Peace would be wonderful. But searching for a certain kind of stillness or temporary cessation of the desperation that I've lived most of my life with, and maybe that rings a bell for some people, that kind of desperate feeling. And I think part of that these days, because of what happened to me, and because I'm 70 years old, a lot of that is mixed in with mortality. If you're younger, it may be too, but you're not aware of it as much as when you get older. So looking for places to meditate in Manhattan. There is one place I go on a regular basis, and I discovered another place, which is it's a kind of a chain meditation place, which makes me wonder, you know. They have meditation halls and instructional buildings and teachers and things in various places here and other parts of the world. And that's the kind of thing that makes me a little leery. On the other hand, who am I to judge? And that doesn't stop me from judging all the time, but that's something I have to alter too. And this place is located, and this is for Manhattan, so I'll explain it. It's located on 24th Street between 6th and 7th Avenue. Suffice it to say, it's a long way. For those who don't live in Manhattan or who used to live here a long time, you know, who've never lived here or never visited here, it's a long way. Not a super long way, but kind of a long trip for somebody, especially in my current mental and physical condition, which is definitely debilitated. It's a long trip, and I usually stay off the subways because they're just too overwhelming. And this time of the year, we're having a bad heat wave in New York right now. But this time of the year, I usually try to stay off the subways because it's really hot down there. When you go down there, that you know, there's no windows or there's no air conditioning. There's no fans. There's nothing down there. But the heat from the tracks and who knows what else the heat is from the trains, from the exhaust. So it's really hot down there. So I walked the three blocks. I live three blocks away from the subway stop at 103rd Street in Manhattan. And I walked the three blocks, and right away, you know, I'm outside of ambulances, trucks, buses. I'm looking for some place that's kind of an oasis that I can temporarily go to get some peace and to really kind of try to figure out who I might be, to center myself instead of desperately running around like the Mad Hatter, you know, grasping for some kind of identity. And as I say, this running around desperately trying to grab for identity could be just a way of avoiding a truth I already know. But that's part of what meditation is supposed to do for you, is supposed to make that clear. If that's what you're doing, it's supposed to make that clear. It doesn't happen like the first 2 minutes of, you know, you sit down. But it's something that happens over time. And I've had some good experiences with meditation. And at the simplest level, it does actually calm me down when I am usually flipping around all over the place. So I go down to the 103rd Street subway, and right away, you know, it's ambulance, trucks, buses. My neighborhood is really just overwhelming. Lots and lots of people. Thousands and thousands of people live there, and they're all on the street. And this was on Saturday. And I go down, and it's hot down there. You go down into the subway, and then you go down even another set of steps, and it's hot. I mean, you know, and you feel it's so hot down there that you almost feel like maybe, you know, geologically speaking, you are closer to the Earth's core. I was 50 feet or let's say 25 to 40 feet closer to the Earth's core, and it was hotter down there. Yeah, that's not the reason it's hot. Or maybe I'm closer to hell, you know? Definitely feels that way. So maybe I'm closer to hell. Maybe that's why it's hotter down in the subway, because it's just 40 feet closer to where the flames of hell are. So I go down there, and on the three blocks on the way there, it's filled. My neighborhood is filled with what's called single room occupancy and some and or welfare hotels. There's a lot of people walking around my neighborhood where many, many years ago, the state of New York dumped a whole lot of, because of some judge's order, dumped a whole lot of extremely psychotic people. He said, you can't keep them locked up forever. They have to go out into the community. That's a wonderful idea, I think, for them and for the community. So on the three blocks, and it's hot, and the summer is beating down on people. America's a hard place to live in now for everybody, but, you know, living in the city here, it's the heat, and everything is so expensive up where I live. So there's this tremendous income inequality. Huge, tall condominiums, many, many, many wealthy people, and even people if they aren't wealthy, lawyers, stockbrokers, doctors. There are people there who have people in IT at high levels. There are people who are making $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year, right, and more. and some millionaires. And they're mixed in with some of the poorest, most badly off people on the face of this planet. You know, I'm exaggerating. Obviously, there's probably people in cities in India, or, you know, in the country in India and various other places like in Africa or maybe in the Middle East who are worse off. But these people out on the three blocks between my house and the subway, just jammed with people who are muttering to themselves and flailing around with their hands so that you have to get out of their way. People who are literally dangerous. There are people who clearly have been just recently let out of jail and have nothing. And people who are on crutches. People who are covered and their hair is matted and they're covered in filth. It's like some terrible scene from a kind of a nightmare, and they're just everywhere, and beggars everywhere, and people, like I say, crazy and drunks lying on the sidewalk, who are, you know, just lying there, who have urinated overnight and sleeping out. And the city is so full of despair and poverty, and during the summer it's worse, and everything costs so much, and these people are begging and begging and begging. And, you know, they have their hands out, and some of them are angry, and some of them are woe be gone. And it's just, you know, and there was this one guy, and I had a couple of dollars, singles, in my pocket. And there was one guy who came over, black guy. They're, and by the way, these people are black, they're white, they're young, they're old, men, women, you know. It's just an oppressive time. It's an oppressive time. I've never seen things worse or more unequal in my neighborhood ever, or in any place I ever lived in New York. There are so many people around this neighborhood who have so much money and who are, what they're wearing on any given day, or what they pay in at a restaurant on a Saturday night, is enough to support one of these poor families or one of these poor guys for probably months and months and months. You know, one man about a block from the subway walked over, you know, just a got beaten up black guy. And he's wearing, a lot of these guys wear heavy clothes because that's the only clothes they have. So when winter comes, they have their coat. So here it is, it's really hot, but he's wearing his coat and he's wearing his one pair of shoes he's got, and he's, you know, wearing a hat, you know, one pair, it's his one hat he's got. And of course he smells terrible. And he comes over, and, you know, you always have your choice whether or not to give alms, to give money to people if you have it, you know, spare change, or, you know, a dollar is a lot of money. People mostly just give change. But up in my neighborhood, some people don't even have spare change. They just reach in and pick out a dollar, maybe a $5 bill. That happens once in a while. But most of the rich people don't give out money. And this guy approached me, and he said, he just sort of mumbled something, and obviously he held out his hand. He wanted money. So it just moved me so much. It moved me so much, some sort of sympathy, some sort of empathy, I don't know what. And I'm thinking to myself, there but for fortune. Is that in any way reality? It could be. It might have been. I've been very close in my time and could be again, my life being what it is and my life having been what it was, especially when I was living by myself, unable sometimes to take care of myself very well, that I could have been living out, you know, on a traffic island in the middle of Broadway or sleeping on the street. I don't know how long I would have lasted. I don't think I have the toughness or the perseverance a lot of these people have. I'm amazed. These same people, year after year after year, wander around, and they're still there. They're still there. They're miserable, but they're still there. They have a certain kind of toughness. I mean, you know, the human being kind of perseveres most of the time. So he puts out his hand out, and I gave him a dollar. I said, here's a dollar. And he said, he looks me straight in the eye, and with real feeling says, God bless you. God bless you. And I said, and God bless you too. You know, and God help us both, I'm thinking. And I'm thinking, there but for the grace of God. So I go down into the subway at 103rd Street at the station, and heat. Like I say, heat, heat, heat. Go down even further. And it's a tremendously, you know, complex mixture of people, variegated mixture of people. There are two blocks away, there's an international youth hostel, which is very well known in New York. And people in their 20s usually, and so you get these bright, fresh people from, you know, France and Holland and Germany and, you know, the Philippines and wherever. And they're all young and fresh and, you know, they're not rich, you know, so they're staying at the youth hostel. And they, you know, they, you know, they're enthusiastic, you know, and they're all down in the subway station. They're all going to take a look at New York or go someplace or do something special. You know, they have their backpacks on. And then there's all the other people on the Upper West Side, you know, who have been, you know, trying to, it feels like the summer's been going on, like, you know, for months already here. I mean, many months. People are already beaten down. And it's not just the heat. It's not just the heat. It's the times we live in. You know, it's that you see more and more people who look more beaten down than I remember people looking. I mean, there's just something about what's going on in the world, what's going on in the country, the fact that your money just doesn't go anywhere anymore. It doesn't hardly buy anything. And people just look, and a lot of people are out of jobs or at part-time jobs when they had full-time jobs, and people are suffering. Middle class, lower middle class, and the poor have it worse than I've ever seen it. And so they're there, you know, those people are there looking beaten down. And, you know, it's like I say, it's as soon as you walk down there, too, there's always somebody playing music at this station. In various subway stations in New York, there are people who play music. There are people who play, you know, a guitar, or they have steel drums, or they play an electric guitar. And sometimes they're extremely good. Some people play the violin, students, you know, from some of the really prestigious music schools. Or the flute, depending on the station. Of course, the train rumbles through and you can't hear them. So they've learned not to play when the train comes through. You know, they break it off. But as soon as the train pulls out of the station, they start playing again. And I always admired these people. I always admired these people because, you know, and people put, they put a hat down or a little box or a cloth, and people drop some change onto it or into it. Sometimes people throw a dollar bill in, and I always give them money. If I don't give a beggar money, I will give one of these people money. It seems to me that this is one of the most honest livings I've ever seen, and I admire their art. Some of them are very good. This guy happened, he had a microphone. This guy happened to be very bad. So the trains are pulling in and out, and they're really loud, and there's like, you know, 200 people down in this station, and they're talking, and there are people also down there, you know, lying on benches, muttering to themselves and sleeping on benches. And so it's a cacophony, right? It's there's a lot of noise. And then there's the announcements, right? I didn't give this guy any music. It's just bad folk music, bad singer. And, you know, there is quality, you know, to be admired or not. But I do always admire, generally, the street musicians, especially the ones down in the subway. And the guys, you know, men and women who play on the streets sometimes. It's they're bringing this beauty, this absolute beauty, this sense of art. And some of them are extremely good. I mean, in New York, some people are really good. Like I say, they're in professional musicians who are down on their luck, or maybe they're students at some couple of prestigious music schools up there's a couple of them where I live. And so you hear this absolutely, you're walking along the city and, you know, the pavement and the trucks and the exhaust fumes and the hard times and everything else. And then in the midst of it, there's this beauty. There's this beautiful melody and rhythm and reminding you once again of the connection between everything and everybody, you know, the music of the universe coming out of these people. So at the same time these people are playing, this guy was playing his folk music, and he didn't stop. He just kept going because he had a microphone. He figured he could beat the trains. The trains are pulling in and out, and there are announcements coming over the loudspeakers. In New York City subway station, they have, so all this is people are talking, and he's singing, and the trains are coming in and out. And when the train opens its doors at a station, when it stops, you can hear the conductor making an announcement. So that announcement is happening. And then there are announcements coming over the loudspeakers in the station. Announcements are coming over the loudspeakers in the station, and they're completely unintelligible. When you're down in the subway system, I mean, Bill Cosby, there but for fortune, right? Bill Cosby once did something, funny, when he was doing stand-up a long time ago, about how a lot of train stations, when you hear the announcements from the coming over the loudspeakers, they're completely unintelligible. I think Lord Buckley also did something like that one, too. But Bill Cosby was saying, and now the 301 from Fresno Smited will be departing from his dashboard of others. Instrument like this. That's what it sounds like. You have, and on the weekends in New York City, they're constantly fixing the subways or rebuilding them or building them anew. And there's something, and the service is for years now. And a lot of this happens since 9/11, but they are constantly fixing the subways and rebuilding them. And so they're always changing at the last minute, or sometimes not at the last minute. They're always changing the train and it's not its direction, but whether it's local or express. If you want to go to a certain station, I want to go to 24th and 7th Avenue from up near where I am on 103rd Street in the subway. You normally get on a local train, but they mix up the locals and the expresses and they run on different tracks and you have to keep your wits about you. And what you want to do is listen for the announcements so that you don't get suddenly the doors close and you're, 100 blocks further away from where you wanted to be on an express train. So I'm down there, and all of the announcements are coming over the loudspeaker. The guy's singing. People are talking. There's music that you can hear that people are playing in some of their devices. It comes out of their headphones and people are playing video. You hear sounds of video games coming out of little machines. I mean, a million sounds, and it's a cacophony of things. It's already making me feel like... Now, keep in mind, of course, that I'm on my way to locate a new place for meditation, which would be sort of an oasis, like calm and peace. But isn't this the way of mythology? That you have to go through this before you reach something like that? You don't just sort of suddenly materialize there. It's a pilgrimage. You have to face, hardships, or else it's not a real pilgrimage. But this is just the beginning of it. And I get on the train, and there are these constant announcements on the train. Something is going on, and they're announcing the conductor, as the train is moving along, it makes a tremendous racket. And people are all talking on the train. They're all talking very loudly because the train is making so much noise, so they talk loudly. At the same time, the conductor is obviously giving some very complicated directions and changes in service, none of which is clear. None of which is intelligible. You can't figure it out. And I'm standing there, and sometimes in New York City, people will get on and they'll bring their bicycles on the train. And every train is crowded in New York City. Every train is crowded because they claim so little money, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, that they have the trains have fewer cars on them now. And the trains run less frequently. But that doesn't mean that still millions of people don't use them every day. So every train all the time is crowded. It used to be if you went in the middle of the day sometime on a train, you might get a place where it wasn't crowded. And then, you look for a seat. And an old decrepit person like me, which would be nice to change, and I'm working on it, really would like to have a seat. And I don't make a big deal of it. I don't sit up and say, oh, I'm so old, I'm whining. I try not to broadcast that because I like to think of myself as, not 90, not actually falling down. But sometimes I feel like that. And actually some days I am more like that. So I'm standing up there. And used to be, and I've mentioned this before, that anytime anybody used to see somebody older, they would get up if they were younger and give them their seat on buses and trains. That doesn't happen at all anymore. It never happens. There's different reasons for that. One is there's more sort of insensitivity and callousness in the society in general about everything. So, screw the old people. Screw the crippled people. Screw the old people. Who cares? I got my seat. And the other thing is there's so many old people, especially in some neighborhoods. And in the neighborhood I live in, has a tremendous number of senior citizens. So nobody ever figured there was going to be so many old people. If everybody in New York gave up their seat to everybody who was old, nobody young would ever sit down in a seat. Well, maybe it's the way it should be, But that's the truth of it. That's how it goes. And that often happens, that people will stand over it. So I'm standing there, and there's some people sitting down in front of me. I'm getting hand signals from oh, is it 20? Okay, 20 minutes left. We're working on our studios here, but I'm getting hand signals from the engineer about how much time is left, because I have to figure out when the hour started, where we are, and everything. Okay, so now I know. You get on a train, and people bring their bikes on sometimes. On a crowded train, you bring a bicycle on. Some people need to do that, I guess. But there's a certain kind of arrogance and insensitivity involved in that. And then some people get on, and they have these carriages, you know, with their babies in them, or their little they're like tiny toddlers. And some of these carriages are like SUVs. They're gigantic carriages. And there was, finally I got a seat. At 42nd, some woman staggered me. She was a woman about 35, a Latino woman. And she said, "Would you like to sit down, sir?" And I said, "Yes, thank you. That would be very nice," because I'm swaying already and stumbling practically. And this is, you know, because of my own health condition of various mental and physical sorts. And ordinarily, I wouldn't bother anybody. But I was very happy that she asked me to sit down. And the people sitting next to me are the two ladies with their SUV carriage. It's gigantic, a gigantic carriage. And everybody has to squeeze away from it. Everybody has to get out of the way. I mean, it takes up so much room. And these two women, they're angling it right out into the middle of the place where people have to stand. They're not trying to in any way line it up or move it back so that people have more space. They couldn't care less. And I'm looking over there, and there's people with stuff in their, you know, everybody's got their thing in their ear, their headphones, and people are talking in a very loud voice because the train's loud, and they have to talk over the announcements. And I'm trying to catch the announcements because I don't want to get caught on the wrong train and wind up in some other place. I want to get, it's hot, you know, I'm tired already, and I want to get to this place on 24th and 7th, this meditation hall, this meditation oasis. I want to get there. I want to see what it's like, because I may be going there on a regular basis. I'm trying to identify these places for the rest of the summer and maybe later on. And these two ladies are sitting next to me, don't care, you know, taking up all this space. And they're talking and talking and talking and yakking away. And their little kid is, as little kids do, they have talk about yoga or being able to being in shape. Kids, they can bend their legs and put their foot in their mouth, you know, without even thinking about it, of course. This kid is chewing on the filthiest shoes, absolutely filthy shoes. And obviously, the kid had been walking earlier, and their shoes were covered with, like, whatever muck is on the street in New York. And the kid was happily sort of chewing, yum, 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 on her shoe, which was completely filthy. And these two women were just laughing and patting her on the head. Isn't this cute? I'm thinking, Jesus Christ. But somebody once told me that babies have a certain kind of protection against this. I don't know, like some special protection, but it's not something I think I would have let my kid do. Anyhow, the train is going along, and sure enough, everybody gets out at 34th Street downtown, and I'm going to 24th. And the train should go one or two more local stops, and I can get off. Suddenly, everybody rushes off the train, and I'm standing there wondering, what's going on? And not everybody, but like about three-quarters of the people rush off the train. Apparently, one of the announcements, which I couldn't catch, and somebody had to tell me because I asked, I grabbed somebody, I said, what's going on? He said, this train is going to run, you know, down to 14th Street. It would bypass the place I was going completely, and I'd have to go change and find another train, so I have to get off the train real quick before the door closes on me and I get, you know, shanghaied, hijacked and kidnapped to another stop I don't want to go to. So I get out on the platform and it's hot and it's the Penn Station platform and there's a million people. People coming in from Long Island, people coming in from New Jersey, people coming in from all over the place. And they are, you know, from different parts of the country, you know, they're coming off trains and they're going different places. So the station is gigantic and it's packed with people and it's hot. And on the train, there's still the announcements from the conductor. There's a guy standing there who works for the MTA with a red vest on, and he's got a megaphone down in the subway, and he's blasting directions and changes that are happening on the weekend, and the announcements from the conductor on the train, and then there are announcements on the loudspeaker coming over the loudspeaker system, all at the same time. Bedlam. Insane Babylon bedlam. Bedlamon, you know, Babylon, just the worst. Babel, Babel, Babylon. And there was, and there are people, you know, so they said, I said, what do I have to do? And he says, well, you're going to have to go down the steps and go over and come up, you know, and everybody. So I go down the steps. People are lost. And of course, there's more everywhere you look. There are people who have just slipped through the cracks, people who can't handle it anymore. And I understand really what that means because, you know, I've been there before wandering around like that. I used to wander the subways when I was so lost. And I'm not so far from that these days, I have to confess. And I'm looking at these, and there are people just sort of slumped over and against the walls and more drunks lying on the floor in their own, you know, urine. And I hope you're not listening to this while you're tempting to have brunch or dinner or something like that, or having a snack. But, and, you know, and I'm looking at these people, but I'm walking along trying to find my, trying to find the right train. And I'm thinking, yeah, there but for fortune. I look at these people muttering, lost, poor, lonely, crazy. There but for the grace of God. There but for the grace of God. And I get out finally at my stop on 23rd Street. And every jackhammer in the Western world is digging up every part of the street at 23rd and 7th. I have to walk one block from there. Huge amount of noise. And then the usual mixture in New York of rich people and poor people. People staggering around and then rich people. Trucks, buses, sirens, some more. And more derelicts. And I passed by one guy who was so miserable, and he asked me for money. And I just, you know, was running out of money to give people. But I'm thinking, yeah. There but for the grace of God. There but for the grace of God. It just kept occurring to me, and I kept feeling it.
Show me the prison. Show me the jail. Show me the prisoner.
Yeah, there but for fortune. Well, finally, I make it to the to the doorway of this, and I walk in to this meditation place, and it was like an oasis. It was cool. They had air conditioning. Calm. There was some wind chimes. They were sort of tinkling. There was a fan blowing. They were tinkling the wind chimes. and a very nice young woman showed me the meditation room, which was this is a kind of a different. There are different kinds of Buddhism. This is a sort of the more the happy, joyous, almost sort of like carnival kind of Buddhism. Not that it isn't, you know, a serious place, but you know, like you find lots of some places you just have this sort of small statue of Buddha, or sometimes no statue at all, like Zen meditation, maybe. But this is the other kind, sort of like where they were in the meditation room and they had a gift shop, these giant, huge painted statues, all different flashy colors of Buddha and other saints or gods or goddesses, you know, and elephants and everything. But it was calm and cool in there. There was nobody in the meditation room, so I sat down for a while, and just because of the air conditioning and because of the way it felt, I literally just sort of chilled out. And I was able to tune away all the stuff that was going on in the outside world, which was pretty grim and pretty crazy. But what I don't know, and I'm still trying to figure out, is am I avoiding doing what I need to do? I believe, maybe. But I'm at least getting some peace and quiet. But the price to pay to get all the way down there. But it's a beautiful place, and it's quiet. They have an atrium. And I sat there for about half an hour and then decided that I was going to go back home. My wife was there. It's the weekend. I don't see her all that much, you know, as much as I'd like to. And so I have to go back out on the street. I got some information from the woman about when they have classes available. And I go back out on the street, and there I am, back out on the street. Back out on the street again, right? And walking over the jackhammers. And another guy comes over and sticks his hand out. Can he get some money? And I felt bad for him, and I gave him some change. It was in my pocket. And so I passed by a Starbucks, and somebody was like, I think he was almost like thrown out, or he was rapidly coming out the door, and he was yelling backwards into the Starbucks. I mean, people are just pissed off. There's a lot of people just pissed off. And this is, I can't say what it's like outside the city, but this is what I see when I sometimes wander through the city these days. And people are down and out, and they're pissed off, a lot of them, in the midst of, and maybe this is part of it, a tremendous amount of wealth on the part of some other people. And it's all mixed together, and it's all unequal. There's this inequality that the rich people don't feel, or the people with money don't feel, but the other people feel pungently. They feel it violently. Well, finally, I get down to the subway, and it's hot, of course, again. And I walk on, a train shows up, and there's the announcements, and it's hot, and it's burning, and it's stuffy, and there's a million people. Finally, I get on the subway going uptown, back up to where I live, you know, go back to my place, my apartment, where my wife is, where my, you know, where my daily life is, and do things. And I walk on, and I'm about to walk in and try to find a seat, and some guy puts his hand on my chest and says, no, you know, just stay right there. I'm right near the door. There's a violent argument going on, but I mean literally violent. There's this big, fat woman and this guy who was kind of smallish, and he was trying to smack her, and she was trying to stab him with her as much as she could in his face and his body with this big, long umbrella she had. And they were screaming at each other in Spanish, screaming and cursing, and then in English. And just, you know, something had happened right before, like about 2 minutes before, as the train was moving from 18th. I don't know what it was. He did something, she did something. And she says, I'm not afraid of you. And then she laps into Spanish again. And he said, yeah, well, you bitch. And he's going on. And she said, I'm not afraid of you, you little prick, you know, and then they're yelling and screaming at each other. And everybody in this train is traumatized. There's people who were from some youth group, and they're sort of cowering in the corner from the Midwest. But fortunately, there was a couple of very large guys there who just stepped in. They just stepped in, and they backed this guy away because he was trying to smack her, and she was trying to poke him back with the umbrella. They backed him away, and he's saying, you know, he's like recounting every awful thing that she did. But it was just such an awful, sad, violent scene. I mean, these people just snapped. I mean, that's how it is, you know, on the train, in the heat, in the city, in the crowds. And he just, and she's screaming at him. It was just traumatizing situation, an awful scene. And a couple of women came over and tried to calm her down, but she wouldn't be calmed, and he wouldn't be calmed. They had to be kept away from each other physically. So finally, she gets – and then they're telling this guy, get off the next stop. You need to get off. He says, it's not my stop, and I'm not getting off because I'm – this bitch, blah, 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 and everybody is backed away, right? Forget about sitting down. Everybody's backed away, and they're yelling, and it's loud. Finally, she gets up and gets off at 34th Street. She gets up, and we're going uptown now, right? And so finally I sit down, but a ton of people come on the train. This is, again, Penn Station. A bunch of Yankee fans came on. You could tell they're from Long Island in New Jersey. It's Penn Station where they come in on a train, trains that come into Penn Station from outside New York. And they got their Yankee jerseys on, you know, Jeter, and they got, you know, Yankee baseball caps on. Big, beefy guys, some of them probably volunteer firemen out on the island. And, you know, decent enough, nice people, but already well into the beer, which you can smell on their breath, right? And they're very loud. They are very loud. They're having a good time. Good for them. They're headed up on the local train to 161st Street, where Yankee Stadium was, because the Yankees were playing the Mariners. You know, at 1 o'clock, and this was around 11:30 or 12 in the morning, or around noon, and they're headed up there, and then everybody's on talking, and everybody's having a good time or a bad time, and then they're like beggars, have, they walk their way through the train, they walk from car to car, and one guy walked through the middle of all this activity, and everybody's still trying to settle down from this violent argument that went on. And he walks through, and he's wearing old, faded, you know, camouflage pants, and such a faded, ragged T-shirt that it was khaki colored, but you couldn't tell what it said anymore. And he looked like death. There was this old phrase, my parents used to use, "Death warmed over." Death warmed over. What a phrase! And he looked like a wraith. He looked like a wraith or a ghost, and he was sick, and he looked like he was. Like that he had just emerged from some awful, awful place underground, and he was pale and miserable, and he's walking through in this monotone, because they do this all day long. He says, "I am a disabled veteran, and I was disabled in the Iraq War. I haven't eaten all day. I haven't eaten all day. Can you spare some change?" I mean, so it sounds robotic, because he's so down and out, and he needs help. And some people gave him money. A lot of people backed away from him because he looked really ill. He looked really sick. Finally, I'm on the local train, and it's supposed to go to 103rd, 103, get out and walk to my house. And naturally, the train stops at 96. It's going to go express at 96, so I got to get out and go upstairs and get out in the sun and get a bus, and I walk outside, and there's a million people there. It's a busy stop, and but finally I get a bus, and I get off, and I walk, get off at 105th Street to walk about a block or two from where my apartment is, and there's this guy muttering, another guy who's crazy and sick, and he's about 20 years old, this guy. His hair is matted. He's filthy. He's dirty. Standing near a phone booth, there aren't too many left, and muttering to himself, absolutely muttering to himself. I'm thinking, geez, what is his story? I mean, what is his story? I think of this young guy, this connection. We're all connected, but what happens to people? What happens to what happened? What is happening to me? What happens to people? How do people get so lost, you know? And how do they get found? I don't know if my pilgrimage is helping me any. Finally, I get back to my place. There's the air conditioning. There's my wife, who I wish I knew how to love as much as I would like to and as much as she loves me. Love not being something I've ever been able to put my finger on too well, but I work on it. And I sit down, and I start to tell her this story. And this young guy comes, his visage, you know, the vision of him comes back with his matted hair and his sad, mad look. And I wonder to myself, what, you know, who is this guy? How did he get this way? Who are we all? How do we get the way we are?
if seeing meant that you would have to believe in things like heaven and in Jesus and the saints and all the prophets. Except for the Pope, maybe in.